David A. Price presents...
Hey Halloweenies, welcome to Marvel Noise episode 305. I'm your host for this Halloween episode, Steve Raker, in the Comic Book Bunker. You can find Marvel Noise as well as old episodes on marvelnoise.com. We've got a Facebook page, we're at Marvel Noise on Twitter, and we're proudly part of the Deliberate Noise Network. We also have a sister show, Indie Comic Book Noise, where various configurations of the gang discuss the indie books that they're digging on. And we are sponsored by nobody. In this episode, we've got Andrew and Kevin joining me to discuss the first and unofficial Marvel-DC crossover back from the 70s, the Rutland Halloween Parade. And then Gravedigger Jerry McDade will be on to execute our annual segment covering a chunk of Tomb of Dracula issues. This time it's issues 32 to 42. But before that, I want to share a recent read that's, well, it's not really Halloween-y, but since it's black and white, it's sort of creepy and moody, and that is Marvel's Shadows and Light, a three-issue limited series from the first half of 1998. And as I said, these were all black and white issues with nice wraparound covers, like the first issue had a Stelfreeze cover, the second one, Lee Weeks Thing cover, and the third one, John Buscema, Claudio Castellini Hulk cover. The first issue also had pinups like Werewolf by Night versus Frankenstein's Monster by Tom Grinberg and a Cam Smith Thor versus the Hulk. There were three or four stories, well, I guess it was four stories per issue, with a opening page, like a lead-in, tip-in page for each story that had short biography of introducing who the creative team was, and then also would feature additional comments by the creators about the story, which was really kind of cool. So the first issue had a 12-page Black Widow story by Gerard Jones and Gene Ha, an 8-page Hulk tale by Bernie Wrightson, one of those rare Bernie Wrightson Marvel works, a 12-page Iron Man story by Len Wein and Steve Ditko, and a 10-page Daredevil by Ron Mars and Stelfreeze. The second issue had 12 pages of The Thing by Lee Weeks, who also did the cover, 12 pages of The Man-Thing by Marv Wolfman and Liam Sharp, 8 pages of Doctor Strange by Jim Starlin, and 12 pages of Spider-Man by Mark Andraco and Jill Thompson. The last issue is the best one, though. It had 8 pages of The Hulk by Roger Stern and John Buscema, 12 pages of The Werewolf by Night by Jim Starlin and Tom Grinberg. And Starlin wasn't necessarily that hot on the Werewolf by Night character until he got into this angle of, well, the story is the Beast tracking and terrorizing a child molester, and ending with the comment that there are things even a beast hates. There's an 8-page Spider-Man story by Keith Giffen, he wrote and drew it, that is really great. I mean, this is a match made in heaven, right? Giffen providing Spidey's quips, and Giffen even says so. Spider-Man's one of his favorite characters, and he loves the way he throws his opponents off guard by, well, you know, all the verbiage he uses during his battles and stuff. And it's a great little story of Spider-Man busting up an abandoned warehouse AIM operation. And, I mean, he really tears the place up, and he has to fight, like, a big mech and all the things that AIM has there and all that stuff. But at the very end, when he's, like, beating on the last guy and saying, you know, where's Doc Ock? And they're like, Doc Ock, like, I don't know what you're talking about. And he's like, isn't this, you know, this warehouse at this address? And they're like, no, that's on the pier across the way. So he had a case of mistaken identity, but you know how those supervillains are with their abandoned warehouse operations. You could just pick one. Then the series ends with a 12-page Bob Layton written and drawn Silver Surfer tale that uses a lot of Zipitone. And there's some pinups, Thor by Arthur Sydam, Silver Samurai and Viper by Tom Grinberg, The X-Men by Andrea DeVito, and Alicia and the Thing with her reach, like feeling his face and then sculpting by Claudio Castellini. That's really great. I mean, pretty cool, right? neat little series if you can dig it out of the dollar bin. Also, a bit of an older series that I rediscovered as I was going through my long boxes is from the fall of 1973 to the spring of 1977 and ran for 22 issues. And this is Weird Wonder Tales. And it was basically a reprint book of old 50s and 60s, you know, Tales to Astonish and Strange Tales stories and stuff. But they picked ones that had more of a sci-fi alien angle to them and provided new covers just as some of the other reprint. But I mean, this is the 70s, right? I mean, I grew up reading Marvel Comics in the 70s. I was five in 1975 when I started seriously buying books off the shelf. And I was exposed to a lot of those old stories through, you know, some of the superhero ones. They had Marvel Double Feature, Marvel Super Action, Marvel Triple Action, Marvel Greatest Comics. There was a Daredevil one. There was for the old horror and Journey into Mystery type stories and stuff. There was Tales from the Crypt. There was Chamber of Chills, The Dead of Night, Uncanny Tales, and Monsters on the Prowl. Issue number one, I also like they had them all under these new covers too, which freshened up some of the designs and got to see some of the current Marvel gang and cover crew drawing some of the old Kirby monsters and stuff, which is also neat. The first issue had particularly notable had The Thing That Devoured a Planet by Al Hartley, and it had The Eye of Doom by Basil Wolverton. Some of those writer or artist kind of as the Crypt Keeper type host from Chamber of Darkness also made its way into Weird Wonder Tales, such as The Man Who Stole the World, which was hosted by writer-artist Tom Sutton in issue 15. And Chamber of Darkness was a 1969 it started, and there was original material. It was like those old horror and mystery suspense stories, but with, you know, like Denny O'Neill working on them and stuff like that. And there was original material for 8 issues. Then it became a reprint book, and they retitled it Monsters on the Prowl. But at that time, some of those original stories, they commissioned a bunch of, like, creator as host tales with Tom Sutton, Don Heck. There was a bunch of guys. And it's pretty cool to see them, characters of themselves and stuff, and them, you know, being the host of these stories. And the reprints of stories from Don Heck, Jack Kirby, Steve Ditko, Joe Sinnott, Bill Everett. Some Venus stories in issues 16, 17, and 18. They reprinted some of the old Venus tales. Oh my gosh, Bill Everett just drew the loveliest, loveliest women. Issue 17 had The First Moonwalk by Gene Colan from Men's Adventures 24. Issue 19 reprinted the first Groot story. And also in issue 19 in the fall of 1976, editorial kind of altered their approach a bit by deciding to have Weird Wonder Tales carry a lead feature and have like a book host. It only lasted 4 issues until the title was canceled with issue 22, but these were the first Dr. Druid stories, although they were reprints from Amazing Adventures, Amazing Adult Fantasy. How's that possible? Well, Roger Stern, who was the reprint editor at the time, and Len Wein took the old Dr. Droom recurring occult character from Amazing Adventures and altered the stories and his coloring to represent them as Dr. Druid installments with new Kirby Sinnott, Ernie Chan, and Dave Cockrum covers. That's why they changed it from the Dr. Droom, right? Dr. Druid was introduced as the oldest Marvel Comics character. They were saying he predated the FFN Spidey. It's funny, too. Like, issue 21 had a Dr. Druid story, and it also had an old Kirby Ayers Gorilla, giant gorilla reprint. But yet the cover has Dr. Druid versus Gorilla, as if that's going to happen inside. So they went as far as not only touching up panels and word balloons and stuff, but in the last issue, 22, they added new panels and pages with the lead Druid feature by Stan and Jack and Dick Ayers, with John Byrne added material. And it's really fun to try to pick out what's what, too. Issue 22 also has a rare Joe Kubert Atlas-era tale called The Strange Ones. Overall, it was a neat little series. Druid would next appear in Len Wein's Hulk run, and she, heck, he'd go on to eventually be an Avenger, right? Crazy. Alright, let's bring on the guys and talk about Rutland. All right, I've got Andrew and Kevin here. What's going on, guys?
Hey, Super Steve, how are you doing? Are you getting ready for a spooky time?
Indeed.
Speaking of a spooky time, the fog was rolling in this morning.
Ah, we've had some froggy mornings around here, too.
Be careful, you know, Dracula can turn into fog.
I know, so... You never know if it's him, or if it's a lot of him, like certain comics that I won't mention.
After the excellent 10-year anniversary episode, I've been going back, sort of listening to old stuff and looking at old stuff, and wanted to talk to about, we had a comment on one of our old shows about our recent 300 episode, and... I know this has been a debated topic, but I don't know that we debated it on air ever. Or if we have, it's been certainly a couple of 50 episode blocks ago. You know, we didn't talk about it at 300 or at 250, I think. But so, go on.
Are you sure this wasn't Kevin under a ghost-like account? Making a comment, because this pretty much echoes what he was saying at the time we did these episodes.
Hey, so, I have supporters, you know.
So, a commenter pointed out with links that, you know, 300 issues labeled 300 have, other ones have been released through various numbering fun and games. Specifically Wolverine 300 and X-Men Legacy 300.
Hey, those are legit. But Thunderbolts 200 never came out, even though they got the 200. So that doesn't count, but those, like, Wolverine 300, that's legit.
Well, they did jump the, like, it may be legit, but I recognize Steve's counterpoint was that how can there be a 300 if there was no 299? Well, but to be fair, they changed the numbering to get those anniversary issues in. So I just thought it was worth discussing. I mean, I did quickly read those issues, too. I mean, there was nothing. The X-Men Legacy one was a one-off kind of... It was kind of a cute story about a guy with a mutant power that people don't pay attention to him. So it lets him sort of walk between the panels of a bunch of classic stories and talk about value. And then Wolverine 300 was like one of a part 900 series where he goes to Japan to fight a... gang war. I mean, it was fun, but I was like, yeah, I don't need to read the other 742 parts of this series. But yeah, I just thought it was interesting to talk about. My concern being that if we don't count these numbering games, when Marvel Noise hits episode 600 and 700, the only ones that will exist will be numbering gimmicks.
Yeah, I mean... The real reason is that we goofed, right? I mean, these titles didn't have a 250, or when we got to the 251, if we missed one, it's because they didn't have a 200, so we weren't on the list. It wasn't on the list. I go off the list. We had the list of all the comics that made it to 100, right? And then from that, we pared it down from that. It's all been from that list. It's kind of, if you didn't make it to issue 100, I'm not... recognizing your 300.
I'll go to your bunker, Steve, and continue the double numbering that Marvel did at one point.
Yeah, well, so they just weren't on the radar, but in spirit of the no prizes of old, we'll say that, you know, if there was no issue 299, if there's no real build-up, I want to see that build-up to the anniversary issue, you know? So we don't recognize... No, it's not that we don't recognize it, it's that we goofed because it wasn't on the list. Thank you for pointing those out. Sometimes these issues we've had in the past, other folks point out some issues, but it's actually that our episode came out before those were even released. So we also
have that as a caveat.
I don't think that's fair. We should time travel, go back. We should tap in the sphere. No, but in your defense, I got to say, neither one of those felt much like a build up to 300 type of thing. So in that sense, it really was just a number on the book in a way.
Something like Spider-Man, though, those are would definitely feel like 500, 600, 700. Like, that's just a continuous story.
Yeah, and let's face it, we have honored the switchings of numberings and stuff just by doing the Captain America numbering and the Incredible Hulk and the Thor Journey into Mystery, all that stuff. So it's true. You know, it's all part of how we do our long boxes, and I like it when it's an ongoing title-y thing. What I don't like it is when they start the annuals over again with number one.
So do you put the annuals at the back?
I do.
Or after a volume ends, do you put all the annuals after that volume?
Usually I put the annuals at the end as it's like an additional title after it. It's Spider-Man Annual now. And I've got all the Spider-Man annuals all there. Because fortunately they go by year, whether you do them by number or not. So you can put them in order no matter what they try to do to you.
Well, now, and it's got to be weird with... Some of these books are hitting, what, like volume 6 and volume 5?
Yeah, it's crazy. All right, well, I was happy to be able to mention to my buddies here and then share with them the Rutland, Vermont Halloween parade and place in comics lore. And you may have seen in some old DC comics and some Batman comics and things, or some, I think there was an Avengers comic and a couple of others that had mentions of Rutland, Vermont and the parade, and a fellow who lived there named Tom Fagan, who was a comic book fan who did some write-in letters to comics. And he was a writer himself, although not for the comic book industry, and had a big, I think it was like a 24-room mansion that now is a bed and breakfast, that he would invite various comics writers and artists from the industry around Halloween up to his place, and they would hang out there and party, and the Rutland Halloween parade, he helped facilitate that, and then also had a big superhero theme. It was like some early cosplay opportunities. In fact, there was a 1970 Boston Globe article about the parade that included mentions of people in costumes on floats going down the parade dressed like Black Panther, Scarlet Witch, Black Widow. You know, this isn't just Superman, Batman, Captain America stuff. Medusa, the Wasp, Quicksilver, the Vision, Captain America, Havoc, Sif, Carnilla, the Red Skull, Nighthawk, Batman, Shazam. And that's before Shazam was owned by DC, and this is just when he was in, just not allowed to be published and everything, when there was the court order against it. So kind of a cool thing. It lasted for years and years, and because such folks like Steve Englehart and Marv Wolfman, Bernie Wrightson, Denny O'Neill, Roy Thomas, Dave Cockrum, Len Wein, various folks had been up there and befriended him, and it slipped through into the comics some. And because of that, Marvel even themselves touted in their bullpen bulletins, I guess it would have been in 1972, as one of the items, with the little exclamation mark, that there is a two-parter between the Mighty Thor and Amazing Adventures. That was their Halloween special of the year. So Amazing Adventures 16 featured the Beast. In fact, it was the last issue of Amazing Adventures to feature the Beast. They talked about it on the editorial page, how, just like the X-Men before him, these characters can't hold a title. Just can't keep a title afloat.
Well, you know, the X-Men, not very successful.
So the cover date, even though it's January 1973, it came out in October 1972. And it is written by Steve Englehart, with art by Bob Brown and Frank McLaughlin, with colors by Glennis Wein, who is Len Wein's wife, and Marie Severin doing caricatures.
Brown and McLaughlin do a pretty creepy looking beast. Like, you're used to this era thinking of, like, Perez making him, like, a fuzzy, friendly guy. This guy in some of these panels looks, you know, like some kind of werewolf, demonic-looking dude.
Yeah. How come Juggernaut, like, has a mustache on the cover?
Maybe it's one of the people dressed up.
He could be.
I like the interior Juggernaut better because he's... I like when the Juggernaut's, like, a big guy, but... looks like he has kind of a bit of a belly. Like, nowadays, if you're a big guy, you're automatically ripped. Like, you just look like a bodybuilder. But I like that, you know, they have big guys that aren't just, you know, all 2% body fat or whatever, you know?
The helmet looks pretty doofy in a lot of places, just like they did when Bob Brown was drawing the X-Men. This issue opens on an open road in Rutland, Vermont, with Marie Severin doing caricatures of Steve Englehart, Jerry Conway, Len Wein, and Glennis. Len is currently writing the JLA over at DC, but the other guys are all at Marvel. They are all driving up to Tom Fagan's annual Halloween party, and they almost run over the beast in the road, and they stop because Englehart's muffler is broken, falls off his car. And this is the time where the beast is just newly blue and furry. It's so kooky. He wears, like, a rubber mask and gloves and puts on a suit to hide his mutation form from must-be-blind-as-a-bat Vera, who's known him, you know, since the days of the Regal Beagle there.
You know those coffee shop girls, Steve? Sometimes they miss a lot. Maybe her glasses need a new prescription or something.
Or it's his glasses, because then I was thinking, well, maybe, you know, he wears the rubber mask and everything, and then he puts glasses on over it. And I'm thinking with the Clark Kent effect, maybe that's enough to take it over the top. So the disguise Hank and Vera, they hit up Englehart and company for a ride. And so the muffler situation begins with them mentioning it and hearing the car clunking along. But as they are leaving, a portal opens up, and the Juggernaut appears. And editorial Roy is like, you know, remember him from Doctor Strange 182 and, you know, several X-Men issues?
It's like, the other thing I miss a little bit, and I know this probably annoys some people, but I really like, because they do the old-timey thing where you get a page or two of, what's this character been up to since the last time we saw him?
How did he get from wherever he was last seen to now? It must be shown. This is definitely that time in Marvel. But, I mean, Juggernaut's... Kevin, this would drive you crazy. He's, like, inexplicably being teleported in and out of Rutland, like various locations in Rutland, Vermont, via these portals. And it's seemingly at random times and locations. He communicates with the... force that's, I mean, it's not clear whether it's like Sidorak. I think this is somewhat before all that mysticism is added to the Juggernaut's deal. And there's this deal about him talking about his hate, and they're saying, like, your hate and the stroke of midnight, and you'll finally get your revenge. And I didn't get that. Like, against who? For what? Charles Xavier doesn't appear in this story. I don't get it.
Well, the Beast was an X-Men, so, you know.
That's going to be his ultimate revenge, to clock the Beast? All right. So, meanwhile, Steve, Jerry, Len and Glynnis, and Hank and Vera check out the Rutland Halloween Parade, and Superman and Batman are clearly visible, although their chest symbols, you know, aren't showing.
And the Flash, too.
Yeah.
I like how they make him look like obvious costumes. Like, they're baggy and ill-fitting.
Except for Glynnis Wynn, who's dressed as Supergirl. And it's like the 70s hot pants Supergirl with the baggy sleeves, the one that I got Dan Parent to draw for me in Baltimore this year, at the Baltimore Con. Just then, there's a portal, and Juggernaut appears again. And apparently he's led by the Beast's emanations, Andrew. They call it that a few times.
Well, the guy shouldn't shower a lot more.
Yeah, it's like, we call it animal musk, right? And then all of a sudden, Glennis Wein disappears. Poof. And Steve, Jerry, and Len are searching for her, and the Beast spars with Juggernaut. Did you guys know that the Beast could swing like a big tree trunk so hard that it could like knock another tree trunk like in half? And I'm not talking saplings, I'm talking big tree trunks.
Well, it has to be, it can't be that big that he can't get his arms around it, though. So, it's a good-sized tree trunk, but not a huge one.
It's like a telephone pole. Well, also, these are the days where the Juggernaut is powerless if his helmet is removed?
Yeah, that was a new one to me.
I thought he was just susceptible to Xavier's mental powers if the helmet was removed, and otherwise nothing can stop the Juggernaut, right?
Yeah, I guess. Well, I wonder if maybe going through the Mystic Force portals or something.
The Beast leads Juggernaut like through the woods in a chase across like a dam power station, seemingly around in circles in the water. It's like a Benny Hill credits chase scene, for crying out loud. Hank manages to shake the Juggernaut momentarily, but then his emanations lead him straight to Tom Fagan's party. And it's funny, Tom answers the door dressed as the Squadron Supreme's Nighthawk.
Well, I also like how the Juggernaut's mystic powers won't let him sink. And I'm like, that's another one I haven't heard either.
Yeah, didn't he like have to walk all the way across the English Channel or something one time?
Yeah, it took him like several months or something.
So this time, though, the Beast does get Juggernaut's helmet off, and Juggernaut makes a break for it. He tries to steal Englehart's car, because they're all still looking for Glynnis Wien. You know, the car with the bad muffler. But the Beast, like, it's like he blows through the sedan's cab like Nova the Human Rocket and takes the Juggernaut out of there. It's like he just shoots right through. Like, it's like an NFL tackle. He's got a full head of steam. You can't even see. He looks just like Nova. You can't even see his legs. And with the Juggernaut's helmet off, the Juggernaut's all growing old.
What?
And he starts saying some weird stuff about, like, how you don't know that I die or something, and then he disappears through another portal to his perceived doom.
This portal is obviously messing him up.
Yes. Hate was the antidote that kept him young from the aging effect of the other dimension. So he has to return there, or he'll age a lot. But it was cool, like, the first time you're like, what do they do? And then you realize they're intentionally aging him. Because the first panel, you're like, whoa, that looks messed. And then you realize, oh, it was meant to be that way.
Just then, Glynnis Wien shows up in her Supergirl costume, not really recalling like where she'd been. But wherever she was, she had a good time, she said.
Hmm.
Then on the letters page, in the editorial box that's yellowed in, just really catch your eye, that you should go look at Thor, because it is rumored that half the people who wandered through this story and the one in Thor are real and have been known to appear elsewhere in comics from time to time. But of course, that's only a rumor. So in Thor 207, which sports a great Gil Kane, Joe Sinnott cover, written by Jerry Conway and also colored by Glynnis Wien, but we've got Big John Buscema and Vinnie Coletta drawing the Thor and Sif stuff, and mirthful Marie Severin again providing caricatures for the Englehart and Conway and the Ween scenes. We open with a great splash of the parade, Superman and Batman clearly visible on the floats. And the gang is reestablished that they're in Rutland, they're on the way to Tom Fagan's in the car that lost the muffler and all that. Meanwhile, there's lots of Thor, Sif, and Thor versus the Absorbing Man, and then Loki's brought into it, and it's all Buscema drawn, and it looks fantastic, and all that stuff is great. But
and Sif in the crazy white outfit that was always a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Maybe silver, white, anyways. Like, all monochromatic.
Yeah, I love that from the Buscema era. Also, they show the guys all teasing Glynnis Wien for her Power Girl costume, which I thought was really funny because this precedes Wally Wood creating the Power Girl character. So it's funny that they're calling Supergirl not Supergirl by calling her Power Girl, and then DC would make a alternate Earth Supergirl be Power Girl. But of course, Glynnis disappears. And in the
I
end,
I wonder why it's her that gets to disappear, you know?
Because she's wearing the other company's colors. Try to keep her panels down to a minimum. In the end, Loki gets defeated, and the final page is an epilogue that shows Steve, Jerry, and Len finding Glenis just in time to see Steve Englehart's car get stolen. And it's clunking away so loud, though, that Len Wein bets Steve 5-1 that whoever stole the car gets stopped by the cops for it.
And Loki is blind. Gets blinded in this episode.
No! Well, that goes back to some of his original myth of getting the serpent's venom poured in his eyes, you know, when he's
and creates earthquakes when his wife changes the bowl that catches the venom.
Speaking of wives, so where was Glenis Wein all this time? Where was she anyway? The crossover didn't stop there, because unbeknownst to the editors at Marvel and DC, Steve, Jerry, and Len pulled a fast one. In Justice League of America 103, which was also in October 1972, which was written by Len Wein with art by Dix Dillon and Giordano, the tale was told.
Oh no.
Yes, it's the first intercompany crossover. The Phantom Stranger, previously only known to Batman, shows up at a JLA meeting, freaks everybody out, and directs them to Rutland, Vermont, to face Felix Faust, who is facilitating these demons to inhabit innocent residents there. We get Wein, Dillon, and Giordano's version of Steve, Jerry, and the Weens losing Steve's muffler on the way to Tom Fagan's party in Rutland and all that, and including we get a reference to Jerry being at Tom's party last year in Batman 237 that Denny O'Neill wrote. The JLA arrive at Tom Fagan's house at the same time as our gang does here. But this time when Fagan answers the door, he's dressed wearing a Batman costume. Which is so funny, right? Because in the Marvel one, he was dressed wearing the Squadron Supreme Nighthawk costume, which was the takeoff on Batman, right?
And I assume that Julie Will Never Believe Me is the reference to the classic DC editor.
Julie Schwartz, who's editing this very issue.
So I like that they worked all this kind of... I wonder if they knew, though. You got to think. I mean, what do they really care? It's like a one-off kind of
How do you know issue. What the other company... How do you know what the other guys are doing for the other company that's going to come out at the same month as far as that kind of subplotty detail, you know?
Well, plus, they all know each... It's not like they don't...
Well, the writers
know each other and jump companies and all that.
The writers knew all each other to do all this, but I don't think the editors knew. Anyway, Tom Fagan convinces the Justice League, hey, while we're here waiting for Faust to make his move and start turning people into demons, why don't you take part in the parade? And so they do, and as well as the Justice League, even more largely depicted than in the Marvel issues, showed the DC characters. We get Captain America, Thor, Spidey, and the Hulk all visible on the floats. But several of the floats suddenly disappear. And their costumed passengers, Glenis Wein as Supergirl included, are possessed and given demonic powers that mimic the costume that they're wearing. So we get to see the Flash and Hawkman versus Captain America and Glenis Wein, Supergirl, and Adam Strange.
Steve, technically, I believe it's Commando America.
and
again, the Marvel guys all have super baggy, lousy-looking outfits.
Yeah, that really looks like a trash can lid for Cap Shield.
You get Batman versus Spider-Man and Batman in the Green Lantern versus Thor, and I'm not talking about just like a panel or in the background. It's like for a few pages. It's really funny.
Well, the nice thing is all these characters have nicknames, so they don't ever have to say Spider-Man. They can say Web-Slinger.
Right. Isn't that why Steve Ditko got mad when Stan finally like wrote down a formal legal document that Steve Ditko co-created the Web Slinger or something like that. And he's like, he didn't say Spider-Man, he called him the Wall Crawler or something like that.
So.
And then the other funny thing is, and again, it's because Shazam, Captain Marvel, had, in, you know, if you know your comics history some, they were published by Fawcett, which was put out of business by DC because in court by saying that Captain Marvel was too much like Superman. Well, here we have Superman versus Captain Marvel, which is kind of funny because in coming months he would start being published by DC. So this was their way to slowly bring him back in as an entity that they wanted to acknowledge existed rather than being the black hole that he had been for the last more than a decade, right? Including there's an ad for later in the issue saying, hey, in the months to come, look for Captain Marvel. Watch out, Superman, the original Captain Marvel. And so they even make, like, they even, like, use the very thing they accused Fawcett of doing with the character as a promotion for the character. Watch out, Superman, the original Captain Marvel, you know, is coming. Crazy. But the issue wraps up with the guys finding Glenis and Felix Faust stealing Steve Englehart's car to make his escape, only to be stopped by the cops because of the muffler. Wah, wah.
Yeah, and this one also had the weird magical gimmick. I haven't read a ton of Justice League from that era, but it does feel like a lot of them had always had some, oh, you didn't say the magic word, or in this case, I had to get this thing that I couldn't explain, and that's how it wraps it up. But it was cool seeing all these characters. I hadn't read a lot of DC from this era in a while.
That is how Englehart, Conway, and the Weens snuck under the editor's radars the first intercompany crossover in 1972 and were able to depict each other's characters in the guise of being people in Halloween costumes and even make their characters fight each other. It's pretty cool.
It was fun. I when you told me about this, I went to the wiki and they list some of these crossovers. And if readers are interested, I would jump over to Marvel Unlimited and read Avengers 83 because that was a lot of fun. Because it's a classic, characters acting weird and goofy from the 70s. And I really like that one.
And thanks to Jerry McDade for suggesting that we talk about this topic. It's been a long time coming, and it's funny that you guys hadn't heard of it, so that was awesome of a way to share it all together for Halloween. So thanks for joining me to do this, and I've got Jerry on tap to talk about some Tomb of Dracula.
Look out for the fog, Kevin. Look out for the fog.
Exactly. You don't know what's going to be in that fog.
Hey, next time, more Thunderbolts, right?
I think so.
I hope.
I think we're going up to almost up to Fear Itself. I think, what did I say, 156 or something?
Don't be afraid of Fear Itself.
Work. We got Jerry here. What's going on, Jerry?
What's up, Steve? What's up, everybody?
What do you think about that? The whole Rutland DC Marvel unofficial crossover thing? It's crazy history, isn't it?
I gotta say, it's like one of the coolest stories in all of comicdom, I think. It's just, I think if someone were to do it now, and it was something I'd never heard of, I would have thought how annoying that these people injected themselves into the story. But because it happened during a time when I was a kid and I thought comics were cool and comic writers were cool, I don't think that anymore.
That was before social media, too. I mean, that was the way of them sharing the inside joke with everybody in a way that now you could just, like, tweet a picture picture of, like, you know, Bernie Wrightson, you know, hanging off a lamppost somewhere or something like that, you know? but back hey. Then, this was their way of being like, hey, fandom, there's this little thing that's going on. It's cool.
Super cool.
And also was super cool is, Jerry, you and I talked about it a couple episodes ago, but you and I finally walked a con floor together. I'm so happy that you came out to Baltimore. Thanks for doing that.
Yeah, I'm glad I did it. I'm glad we finally got to meet in person. That was awesome. I don't know I'm doing Baltimore again. But I hope that we run into each other somewhere else.
Yes, but...
frequently.
Yes, you saved me scratching my way somehow to get out west to somehow meet you in person. So that was cool. And your brother. Way cool.
That's right. My brother, Dan.
The brothers McDade.
Yeah, we had dinner tonight, and I was telling him I needed to rush home and prep for the show, and he goes, oh, tell Steve I said hi. And I was like, oh, yeah, I forgot you guys know each other now. It's weird, Steve. Worlds colliding.
And you introduced me to Dan Govar, which was really cool, too. And
he
did that nice Red Sonja piece for me. And I got to chat him up about the Tolkien stuff. We shared that interest. So that was a lot of fun. That was awesome, man. Walk the floor and point at creators and go, there's that guy. That was cool.
There's that guy.
Yeah.
And listening to you talk to them is the best part for me. I've only ever heard your stories of your conversations with creators, but watching the magic happen was even better. Oh. Especially when we went to Tom Palmer's table with my, and I had that artist edition for him to sign, and you brought up the Tomb of Dracula artist edition that's coming that we both ordered, and he was less than excited about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of deflated the sales a little.
Yeah, less not excited about it, and at the same time now charging for signatures. So I'm wondering somewhere if there was a little shift in his philosophies.
Sure, sure. Well, be glad that you got the 50% discount off of what I had to pay. For some reason, I got that kind of face, I guess.
In my omnibus, I've got his signatures in the Tomb of Dracula omnibus. And then that brings us to that the past couple of years around Halloween, you've come on the show and joined me reading the Tomb of Dracula series right from the beginning. And most of which, I mean, like really most of which, I've never read before. So this has been fun for me.
100% new for me every time we do this.
On Marvel Noise 255, we did the first 10 issues. That was in October 2015. And then we did 11 to 21, the next episode on 256 in November. And then we did issues 22 to 31 last year in October of 2016 on Marvel Noise episode 281. And then this episode, we're going to cover issues 32 to 42, which encompasses most of 1975, just into the beginning of 1976. And these issues are, of course, by the creative team of Marv Wolfman, Gene Colan, and Tom Palmer, providing both inks and colors.
Man, what an art team. Love these guys together.
And these issues you can find on Marvel Unlimited digitally. You can find them. They're available on Comixology if you want to pay for them. And these issues kick off the first third of the second hardcover volume of the Tomb of Dracula omnibus. And I bet you they are in a black and white essential somewhere, too.
Ooh, that would look good.
Yeah.
So good.
But Tom Palmer wouldn't like it. I don't know.
As long as he's consulted, I think he's good with that.
So other than Dracula, our recurring cast that we have, I'll do a little roll call of the half a dozen recurring characters that have lasted this long. We have Quincy Harker. He's the elderly, wheelchair-bound vampire hunter. And he and his dog, Saint, really are Dracula's greatest foes somehow. There's Rachel Von Helsing, the blonde, blue-eyed femme fatale, who has a family history of encounters with Dracula, and her silent protector, Taj Nital. There's also Frank Drake. He is a descendant of Dracula, and he's a pretty flaky loser type. Inspector Chelm from the Yard, don't you know? He's on Drac's case. And then there's Blade, who's the streetwise vampire hunter whose mama was killed by a vampire.
And he will have his revenge.
Someday, some way. So the first issue we're covering, well, it's the best one we're going to cover, I think. It's a character piece on Quincy Harker. He is awaiting Dracula in his English manor, mansion, space. And he's lured Dracula there with a folder report on Dracula that he and, I guess, Inspector Chelm have assembled.
Right.
And Dracula confirms that he's coming with a phone call, which I thought was polite of him to RSVP.
He really does like to remind him that he doesn't fear him at all. He respects him. He'll let him have that. But he has no fear. None.
And again, as we've talked about in past segments, I think, we're treated to this effective dual storytelling style with here three pages of side-by-side columns chronicling the whereabouts of both Taj and Drake, who are not together. And when we last left Taj, he had been called back to India to support the wife he had abandoned. She's caring for their, like, vampiric, like, adolescent son. And to quote Mel Brooks, the villagers are revolting. They certainly are.
they sure are, especially this guy, the painful close-up of his teeth. Eesh.
Taj is trying to stop the villagers from getting to his kiddo, but he can't stop it, and honestly, it's got to be done, right?
Yeah, better them than him, I guess.
Meanwhile, Frank Drake is in Brazil, trying to find himself, taking on a job for an old friend, and, I mean, we've seen what Drake's old friends are like in the past. I told you he was a loser type. And unfortunately, this job site he gets sent to, it's like he was set up because it's full of like these murderous zombies.
Oh, but Steve, they're not zombies because of the comic code. These are Zuvembies.
Zuvembies.
That's right. The comics code prohibited the use of the word zombie. So that's what Marvel cooked up. And I remember this was Howard or somebody wrote a story, then used the word,
yes.
And Marvel kind of lifted it.
Well, Marvel had the Robert E. Howard license with the Conan and the Solomon Kane and the Cullen everything. So I guess they felt entitled to be able to use Robert E. Howard's zombie Zuvembi, which first appeared in Weird Tales in 1938 in The Pigeons from Hell. That was the short story. And, well, Drake's friend who set him up, totally working for Dracula. It's all part of Dracula's plan to separate the Scoobies and leave Quincy alone and defenseless.
So now, by my count, this is two friends that Frank Drake has had, and they've both worked for Dracula. Do I have that right?
Yeah. The first one gave him the mansion, right, or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, Quincy being left defenseless, Quincy's not defenseless. He's got the chair with the snapping metal bands with the wooden, like, stake lever that would pop up if Dracula would just sit in it. He's got Saint, the crucifix-collared attack dog. He's got a wooden spear cue stick.
Yes.
A billiards table that flips up and becomes a big cross, like the computer panels in Peter Parker's living room back in Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends when it would change over.
Only more holy.
And there's like cloves of garlic that fall from the ceiling, like tribbles falling on Captain Kirk. And, of course, the poison-tip darts that shoot from his wheelchair. Although,
yes,
this time Dracula knows to pull out the one that hits him, right? Remember that one where he stumbled around for the, like, entire issue before he, like, someone else pulls it out for him? But meanwhile, Dracula and Harker are having this great chat. I really like the dialogue here. They're really, like, old friends. Like, they needed this time together to catch up.
Right.
During the fray, too, I thought it was an interesting scene. Dracula dislodges Quincy's glasses. My glasses, I can't find my glasses. And we see his eyes are, like, partially vampiric.
Right.
It's like he's been forever changed and super light-sensitive now from suffering repeat bitings from Dracula. Eey.
Oh, man.
But in the end, though, it's wooden arrows from the walls that take down Dracula.
A ton of them. An avalanche of them.
But Dracula, he's got an ace up his sleeve. He reveals that his vampire girls have Rachel Van Helsing hostage. And a phone call to Rachel confirms this. Although she's like, kill Drac anyway. Don't worry about me.
But does she really want that? Because the way she answers the phone is, thank God you've called. They say they're going to kill me. Like, if you wanted him to go through with it, you probably want to keep that part on the down low.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, oh, I'm just cooking some dinner. What are you doing?
And it's hard.
Maybe you start like that.
Hard to sacrifice her to when Jean draws her so lovely here.
Yeah.
Issue 33 starts with, Harker's wrestling with whether to sacrifice Rachel and kill Dracula for good, which would, you know, save countless others down the line, or allow Dracula to live to spare Rachel. He recalls...
So,
well, go ahead.
This is kind of where I've been struggling with this segment that we read for this episode. We're going to have this theme a few times here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's kind of an interesting tug on Harker because he has so many reasons to want to kill Dracula. And they kind of cook up these schemes where he has him, but he, you know, can he do it? Because if he does, this terrible thing will happen. And then, you know, if he doesn't go through with it, some other terrible thing is going to happen. And it's, I don't know, it's, I hate it.
It's,
is that okay?
And he's also seen Dracula come back from the dead so many times that what makes him ever think that it's going to be final anyway, you know? I don't know.
I'm really starting to think he doesn't want him dead. This is the only thing that gives his life purpose now.
Yeah, but the reason why is you know, he recalls promising his daughter, for instance, that she'd never become a vampire at his wife, her mother's grave. And
right.
Remembers even further back to when Dracula attacked him and his wife like some phantom at the opera. And Harker there was thrown from their box seats, which is how he was crippled. And really savagely, Elizabeth, Harker's wife, was bitten and then taken captive by Dracula, only to be found 2 days later half drained of blood, but still alive.
This is really the key moment in their relationship, right? This is where they go from being foes to, like, arch nemesis.
Yeah, it's harsh. I mean, she recovers physically eventually after, 4 months of blood transfusions and stuff. But never emotionally. She would have horrible nightmares and stuff and see visions of Dracula coming for her and eventually commit suicide with a silver-tipped butcher knife.
It's tragic.
So that's it. Remembering this, Rachel's going to live. Drac is revived. He pulls out the wooden arrow and Drac, you know, freshens up a little. And he calls Rachel and she's pissed that he let Drac live. And I thought it was a really, you know, they have a little fake label on the cover like a little ribbon on the cover of a bunch of these issues that it's America's number one fear mag, you know? Uh-huh. Here's one of those creepy moments, I thought, because Rachel is recounting about her vampy, like, captors, that they were sick and twisted and they did things, and it's just like, ooh. I don't want to imagine. No, I do want to imagine. No, I don't. No, I do.
See, 20 years earlier, we would have known what things they did. They would have been able to draw them right into the comic.
Dracula's like, she exaggerates her pain. You know, come on. She's alive.
No big deal.
She's alive. Come on. Dracula learns from Harker that he likely has 2 weeks to live due to his weakened state. And he gives him some props. He says, like, you're my fondest foe, not like that wet rag Cagliostro, you know? And then Dracula cruelly chucks the ashes of his dead daughter at Harker on the way out the door. That was rough.
Yeah, I mean, what a way to repay him, right? And you would think now, with Harker having lost his wife and daughter to Dracula, and now Dracula giving him this final insult, like, this would be the last straw for Harker. He would never give quarter again. Right?
Never, ever.
Ever.
And it's funny because these issues are monthly, too, so the time in between, it wasn't like back when it was bi-monthly. So it's like these recurring themes really do happen pretty, you know, it's all within a calendar year on the stands.
Sure.
Well, there's also some interludes where Taj gets a happy ending. As happy as it can be for Taj. He buries his vampire son. He's reunited with his wife in India. And the next issue, he pens like a goodbye letter to Rachel. And that's it for Taj. He's written out of the series.
Very happy for him. But sad for us, because he was my favorite character.
He was cool.
Super cool. Super badass.
And his wife is very his wife is very understanding too about his kind of connection and relationship that had developed with Rachel too and everything, and even encourages him to write her a letter and all that stuff. Things are going to be okay for Taj. We also see a barfly, this guy Snitcher, gets killed by a vampire who is to be the mysterious white-haired vampire that killed Blade's mother, only he's not white-haired, like, at all.
That's who this is? I didn't pick up on that.
See what I'm saying?
Oh, man.
And Dracula realizes his weakness is... It's like ever since he was hooked up to Dr. Sun's machine, back in issue number 21, which is Marvel Noise episode 256.
Check it out.
Dracula thought Dr. Sun was dead, but he must be back. Now, who is Dr. Sun? Dr. Sun is a disembodied brain of a Chinese scientist. And he needs blood to keep his brain alive and was going to use vampires to provide a supply of blood for him. And he was going to make a new vampire lord out of this vampire by transferring Dracula's memories to the vampire. And he was hooked up to the machine, too, like between them. And he must have siphoned Dracula's powers during that transference. Maybe that was all a ruse.
Hmm.
So Dracula sends his last thrall, Bennington, to steal the Yard's report on him, and then rendezvous with him. But Inspector Chelm is waiting for their meeting with a bullet.
Oh, snap.
In issue 34? Thinking back, Taj got a happy ending. What about Frank Drake? In true Drake form, this issue opens with Drake getting his thanks in the form of being thrown off a cliff in Brazil by Zuvembis.
It's okay, though, Steve. Don't worry, because physics don't work the same way in Brazil that they do here. So being thrown off a cliff isn't as bad as you might think.
But just then, Brother Voodoo shows up and rescues Drake with Loa power, and Drake does the physics thing that you talk about, and they fight together against the horde of Zuvembis. Back in England, Bennington gives Dracula the dossier, which confirms Dracula's suspicions. It is Dr. Sun, you know, who has been siphoning his power, and he's located in Boston. Just then, Chelm shoots, but Dracula pulls Bennington right into the trajectory instead, so he gets killed. Also, the white-haired vampire, no longer brown, now it's kind of a darker gray, which is funny because Palmer is the colorist and inker too, but I guess the copy goes, you know, the lettering went in after that. But he watches, this vampire is watching from the shadows and reveals to the reader that he has been stalking Dracula and that there's some history there. He calls him master in air quotes. You should see Gene Colan drawing him in, making little air quotes. Dracula fights with Chelm a little bit, but backup quickly arrives to save Chelm, and Dracula is all shot at as he flees in bat form. Chelm then rendezvous with Harker and the psychologist, Dr. Scott, to profile Dracula's actions and motivations and location and stuff. And Rachel arrives on scene, and they determined that Drac's got this weakened state, and it's due to Dr. Sun. They basically catch up to where Dracula is. Then we get introduced to Daphne Wilkerson. Wilkerson, Steve, right?
I love this little bit. This is one of my favorite parts of this whole segment.
She is the publisher of a failing women's fashion magazine. And I know what a fashionista you are. That's why you like this, right?
You know it.
She is a man-hating feminist. Like, only will hire women even if the magazine material is suffering. She's on her last leg financially. The bank guy comes and tries to reason with her, but she throws him out, disrespects him. But just then, there's a lot of that in this series. Just then, Dracula crashes through her window. He's weak, he's shot, he's clutching the report, which she reads. And she has this evil epiphany where she calls the bank guy back, pretends to seduce him, and then sicks Drac on him to rejuvenate Dracula. Sweet revenge!
Now, why Dracula didn't just bite her, it's not important. It would have been way less interesting. Just go with it, everybody.
Yeah, I mean, issue 35 begins, again, it's surprising. He's acting in debt to Wilkerson, I guess. He agrees to kill 4 more marks of hers. Sweet revenge! The first is a guy who stole her designs and sold them as his own. And this is a pretty cool sequence where Dracula takes him down while he's shaving, and it's in front of his wife, and then he turns to her and he's like, "You're next." The second guy is guilty of the same thing. Dracula takes him out for a drink first, and then kills him in a stall in the John. The third guy is wearing a wife beater and lifting barbells when Dracula arrives.
Oh, doing backflips, don't forget that.
And when he's guilty of disrespecting Daphne by not taking her seriously because she was a woman. Seriously.
That's right.
He fights. He throws the weights at Dracula, but it's no good. He's a goner. The last guy, he gets taken out in his vehicle, which gets driven off a cliff when Dracula, like, materializes next to his driver. That was pretty cool.
Oh, it's important to remember that in the middle of all this, Dracula stops back at the office to refuel, and she has set him up with one of her assistants, who is wearing very little clothing at the time. Titillating.
She's really, become, she's really benevolent.
To no one.
She's really become a benefactor for Dracula, yeah. Here in her benevolence. Eesh. Well, when Dracula returns at the end to the smug Wilkerson, 3 days later, after killing the 4, he's not alone, is he, Jerry?
No, he's not. And this, when you said 3 days later, I finally realized the significance of this, because he promised her that he would kill one person a night for 3 days, right? But then he snuck off and killed all of them that first night. And Steve, why did he do that?
Why else? So he could turn them. So he shows up, marches in with them having turned her marks, having been turned into vampires. And of course they want her blood. Sweet revenge.
Woo-hoo. Sweet revenge. Man, that's a great ending. I really like that one.
Oh, and Voodoo and Drake fight off the Zavembis. Thank the Loa.
Yay.
In issue 36, Dracula, having learned that Dr. Sun is headquartered in Boston, Massachusetts, needs to get to the USA. So this issue is told by these interweaving scenes of Chelm Harker and Dr. Scott listening to an audio statement from a pilot recounting how Dracula was a stowaway on this experimental jet he flew between continents and then was hijacked to Boston by Dracula. And Dracula, weakened, escapes this military firefight when they land, diverted to Boston, when they land on the tarmac by turning into a bat and flying away, as he likes to do when he's getting shot at.
Chicken.
Back in Brazil, too, Frank Drake confronts the buddy who set him up, admits that it was all Dracula and that he was so afraid and all that. And Dr. Scott puts Quincy and Rachel on a plane to Boston and then calls his master, Dr. Sun. These doctors. Such an exclusive club. They stick together. Issues 37 and 38, I bought off the spinner racks as a 5-year-old.
Whoa.
And, you know, surprisingly, the series didn't connect with me at the time. So,
huh.
I only bought the Doctor Strange and Silver Surfer issues that would follow the next year, and those were really the only issues of Tomb of Dracula that I had in my collection, which is why most of this stuff is new to me that I haven't read in other little reprints here or there.
Two more than I owned. I was still in diapers at this point.
Oh, I was a 5-year-old, though. That's weird to think of my kids, even at their own age, is reading this stuff. But issue 37 starts with Dracula walking the parks of Boston in search of Dr. Sun. He's weak, but he still manages to toss around a few meddling civilians.
Damn hippies.
Enter Harold H. Harold, writer for Midnight Publishers, who specialize in the occult. Harold's beat is writing true accounts of vampire encounters that he makes up. He is under considerable pressure from his boss, Mr. Headley, to come up with a new piece, a blockbuster piece. And Harold's trouble is that he has no inspiration, other than maybe the crush he's got on Headley's secretary, Aurora, who's quite a doll.
Yeah.
Harold spontaneously promises Headley during a meeting that he has an interview with a vampire all lined up, which is interesting. I assume you're, if you haven't read it, that at least you're familiar with the Anne Rice interview, yes, with the vampire book. That was published a year later than these issues.
Oh.
Being 5 at the time, I don't know what type of press or hype there was for novels that came out, if there was more attention on them than there is now, or what the, you know, was that something that people knew was coming? But the whole idea of the interview with the vampire, it's weird that it kind of is right around the same time.
Yeah.
It's like a Swamp Thing, Man Thing.
Zeitgeist.
Without the thing. Steve. Also, no. In an interlude, we see Dr. Sun's henchman for the first time, who is this silver spear-handed, scar-faced Juno.
Yeah, not some quirky teenage pregnant girl. This is a serious Frankensteinian, creepy, spear-handed guy.
He's got all stitches on his scars and everything still.
Oh, man, Juno is, he's awesome. I really dig this guy.
He's the new Taj.
Yeah, you can keep your Taj. We've got Juno now.
Harold comes upon a motorcycle wreck on his way home from his meeting with Headley and Aurora. The wreck, a result of Dracula feeding, but Dracula's still weak. He can't stand. He's, like, losing consciousness. After Harold spots Dracula's fangs, he feels like he's struck gold, and he takes Dracula home with him.
Just throws him over his shoulder and carries him back to the apartment. No big deal.
First thing he does when he gets there is call Aurora, who we see taking a sensual bath and reading about vampires. She'll be right over, though. This is great.
Yeah. She just got back from a heavy date at 2:30 in the morning.
And for the last time, fortunately, we're shifted back to Brazil, where Brother Voodoo gives Drake a pep talk. A serious, much-needed, like an intervention-style pep talk. And then teleports him to where Quincy and Rachel are, which is in the airport, having just arrived in Boston. So the Scoobies are reunited.
Yay! And, I mean, we really should give Voodoo credit here. Like, this kind of turns Frank Drake around, right? A completely different guy after this pep talk.
Yeah, he would have been an omelet on the rocks if it wasn't for Voodoo to begin with.
Well, there's that, too, sure.
That's what we say about when we're rock climbing, about the guy who leads the climb being afraid, is that better a chicken on the lead than an omelet on the rocks. Issue 38 starts with Dracula looking to attack Harold, but he's too weak to pounce. Aurora shows up. She's all dolled up and is immediately smitten with Dracula. Like, he's so dreamy. They then concoct and execute a scheme to steal some of the blood supply from the Harvard University Medical Center. And, of course, Aurora seduces an intern while Harold steals the blood, and then they split.
Steve, I just call that Thursday night, man.
Harker, Drake, and Rachel observe what appears to be Dracula flying around and follow by automobile. Turns out it's a hologram leading them to Dr. Sun's lair.
Impossible!
Dr. Sun's got all the top mid-70s equipment. That's like how Project UFO is debunking UFO sightings and stuff. It's a hologram by this projector over here. So Dr. Sun, the disembodied brain in a box, explains his plot finally. He wants to take Dracula's vampiric powers and take over the world. Harker blasts Sun's computer banks with those wheelchair darts of his, but he only manages to destroy this machine that siphons Dracula's power.
I mean, if he can't kill Sun himself, that's not a bad second place, right?
Yeah.
I'll take it.
And interrupts the plan, at least. And Juno, then, he's slapping around Harker and Drake. Then, just as Harold was being humored by Dracula to maybe get that interview, Juno busts in on Dracula, who's all revived and hanging out back at Harold's house.
That's an awesome half splash of Juno, too. It's like my favorite panel of the whole issue.
The coloring on it and everything is... I can tolerate the yellow coloring because of knowing that the guy is weird, decayed, you know?
Yeah.
Juno leads Dracula to Dr. Sun's lair, where the Scoobies are all tied up, watching, and Harold and Aurora follow undetected.
As you do.
In issue 39, Juno does battle with the weakened Dracula. He's got, you know, the silver-spiked hand, and he's got these spikes on his feet.
Yeah. He's like a Frankenstein version of X-23. Right?
Totally. And they're sparring. They spar for a few pages. It goes back and forth. Nice to see some action. And at one point, Juno's spike gets caught in the wall, and Dracula's all gloating, but he gets that foot spike in the forehead.
That's a bad day. If he was a Zuvembi, he would have been all done.
Harker is realizing that since, I mean, let's be honest, the world still turns when Dracula's alive, right? but we don't know what happens if Dr. Sun succeeds in his plan. So maybe he's the better of the two evils here, Dracula, that is.
Yeah, let's root for Dracula. You know what happens when you root for something, Steve?
Well, at least when Frank does. Harold and Aurora show up just in time to distract Dracula, which allows Juno to run him through with his silver spear hand, which then detaches and remains embedded in Dracula's heart, which is cool.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm wondering if it, like, does it just detach, or did it, is there, like, an ejection? Could he have, like, shot it at him across the room?
I guess we'll never find out.
Dracula turns into a skeleton, which then Juno cremates into ashes with flames. And Harold, Aurora are taken captive along with Quincy and Rachel and Frank and locked in a room. They easily escape it, though. Rachel's got a hair clip, lockpick, crucifix thing. And Aurora does her bit and distracts a guard by showing a lot of leg.
Yeah.
But it's all okay with Dr. Sun because he was counting on their escape, Jerry.
Well, hey, wasn't he thinking ahead?
He is a thinking head. He's a disembodied head. What Dr. Sun wants is for them to escape and bring back an army, which then he's going to control. Harker was thinking that Dr. Sun was going to make the same mistake that Dracula has made in his calculations of wanting to take over the world. That if you turn everybody into vampires, there's nobody else to feed on, right? That's not going to work. So how's it going to work for Dr. Sun? Well, Dr. Sun wasn't going to turn everybody into vampires to control them. He was going to amplify Dracula's mind control powers, his mesmerization powers, and mind control everyone. So he wants the Scoobies to go bring him an army, which then he can control to begin amassing his army.
And they oblige.
They do.
Here comes the army. They're not excited about it, though. They think it's probably a bad publicity stunt to go cruising into the middle of New York or Boston. Where are we? Boston.
The final page of 39 has a U.S. general conceding to Quincy Harker that, like, the FBI, Scotland Yard, and the president all vouch for them. And so, like, you know, you're in control of the military. And Quincy orders the very attack on Dr. Sun that he's hoping for. Issue 40 opens with Aurora waking. She's startled from a nightmare that recounts Dracula's death at the hands of Juno, which I thought was a clever way to catch the reader up and have Dracula somehow appear in this comic. Rachel comes in and she's consoling Aurora. She confides in her that, like, Dracula had a hold on her as well and probably still does, and how he came for kisses from her on her 16th birthday and everything.
What a perv.
But Harker interrupted with those damned wheelchair darts of him. He had him even then. And Rachel is also trying to get Aurora just to understand that, like, her connection to Dracula is pretty much because of his vampiric abilities. But Aurora ain't having none of that. She just thinks he's dreamy and that he's a real turn-on. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And she's not wrong.
Harker, Drake, Harold, Aurora, and Rachel waltz with that army right into Dr. Sun's trap, and he hypnotizes the army. But not the Scoobies. It's selective. So they have to fight their way to an escape back to Harold's apartment.
Yeah, so some kind of army here, I guess, if four regular Joes can punch their way through and steal a Jeep.
Yeah, I don't know if that was their main mission, to take out them. But anyway, while they're licking their wounds, the Scoobies strategize and determine that they've got to find a way to revive Dracula if they want to defeat Dr. Sun.
I mean, what other option do they have, right?
Rachel's...
This is where you would usually say, well, the Fantastic Four are off-world and the Avengers are busy fighting the Beyonder or whatever.
We're not...
But no.
firmly set in the Marvel Universe until our next time that we cover a chunk of issues where he encounters both Doctor Strange and Silver Surfer.
Too little, too late.
But Rachel's the dissenting vote. She's like, forget it. Dracula will find another way to defeat Dr. Sun, you know? And Drake and Rachel and Harold are the crack squad that returns to Dr. Sun's base to infiltrate and steal Drax's ashes. They encounter Juno, who's impedes their, you know, egress. But Rachel crossbow bolts him right through the heart, dead.
Dang.
Maybe she's right. Maybe there is another way. Maybe they could have taken out Dr. Sun another way, because she just offed Juno.
He got twanged to death.
In issue 41, the gang is researching Harold's library of occult books and magazines and journals, trying to find some way to bring Dracula back from an urn full of ashes. Harold finally finds a revivification bit, but it requires the tears of a virgin. And it's like, where are we going to find one of those?
Just throwing shade on the ladies in his presence, right?
Or how about all of Boston, I'm thinking. Like, I know the old rhyme, Lin Lin, the city of sin, all that, but once... don't come out the way you go in. But in, you know, while Harold is stating this, the amorous, sultry presented Aurora, who was cradling the urn with Drax's ashes in it, that must have been an ashtray because it's got a hole on the top right where you would ash. She cries a tear, a lonely little tear that right falls into that hole, and it ignites the spell.
What?
Who would have thought that all that she was putting on was just a front? I mean, they really went out of their way to... they went out of the way to show that she's the one who, like, teases the men with this and that and everything, and it's a big curveball. Harold, too. Harold thinks he's going to be sick. And so Dracula is revived, and honestly, he's quite grateful. Even acknowledges his role that he's now, you know, supposed to go take down Dr. Sun, or Dr. Sun's floating brain. And he also rubs it into the Scooby's face that now he's going to go munch on an innocent or two, and that's on them.
Yeah, and they have plenty of blood reserves in the fridge, but he turns it down and he says, I'm going to go murder someone, and it's on you.
When Dracula is feeding on his shapely, fashionable victim, Vampire Hunter Blade arrives on scene. He's been tracking that white-haired vampire. It's the one that killed his mama. And he's tracked him right to Boston, because that vampire is tracking Dracula. You get it? So Dracula is stating that he's got a truce right now with Harker and company and takes Blade to them. Blade can't believe it. Even after briefly reuniting with them, Blade... he's not helping out no vampire, not now, not ever, and he's out.
I'm with Blade.
And I love some of the banter back and forth. Like Aurora, she says, Dracula wouldn't harm me. I love him. And Blade says, baby, he'd slaughter you without even thinking about it if he had the whim to. Which, that in itself is a contradiction, right? Because having a whim is thinking about it. But Aurora says, was he right, Dracula? Would you really kill me like he said? Dracula's like, of course, my dear, but I'm not about to as long as you amuse me, and then walks away. She turns to Harold and says, see, Harold, I told you Dracula really cares about me.
Oh, Aurora.
Dracula gives Rachel her propers for offing Juno, and then heads off to Dr. Sun's lair, where Blade secretly follows. We also get this weird two-panel interlude of these two kids going out trick-or-treating. One of them's dressed as Spidey, and, you know, it's as seen on the cover and all that.
Right.
But it's really pointless.
Red herring.
Dracula with, yeah, I guess. I guess
like the cover shows them being, you know, they're about to be murdered by Dracula or whatever. So you know they introduce them here in the middle of the story, and they're heading to the same place Dracula is. So you think you know what's coming.
Dracula, over the course of the next like 7 pages, fights his way into Dr. Sun's lair. He is tossing around soldiers. He does this mesmerization deal on one guy. Like, how many times can you be mesmerized, right? This soldier's already mesmerized by Dr. Sun, and now he's twice mesmerized because Dracula further mesmerizes him to shoot himself in the head.
Oh, man, that was like the dark... This issue has some dark scenes in it, and that's one of them.
Dracula finally reaches Dr. Sun, but their meeting is briefly interrupted by the doorbell ringing. It's the two kids! Who?
Oh, no, kids, get out of there!
Then they just proceed to go on to the next house because no one answers the door. There's no advantage given to either Dracula or Dr. Sun in their standoff by the interruption or anything other than just acknowledging that the bell rung. There's seemingly no purpose to this at all, except for, like you said, a red herring, or was the cover, you know, was it done like an old Silver Age DC comic where they drew the cover and then had to work it into the story, or they just wanted to kids to buy Spider-Man Halloween costumes that year or whatever, but that was really weird. And I even looked, like, were the kids named so that it was, like, Marv's kids or something? No, it's not. It's weird. Dr. Sun then attacks Dracula with a blast of, like, what I assume are sunbeams. But Dracula evades just as Blade drops in to announce his assistance.
Hey! What happened? Cavalry has arrived,
what
right?
What happened to no
Good
time?
Things are going to happen.
I'm never going to team up. I can't help Dracula no time, no ever.
Maybe now.
It's my moral code. It's the code I live by.
It's more of a credo.
In issue 42, our last issue for this chunk, it's an all-out melee as the issue opens with Dracula and Blade fighting side by side against this mesmerized army. And the top of the first two pages, which I guess in the regular issues wouldn't have been side by side because, you know, you open up the cover and you get a splash page and then the next page is behind it. Right. But in the omnibus, they put the cover on the first page. So when you open it up, you get, you know, this gatefold of two pages and it's the, and you get to see the top of the two pages showing this sequence of the white-haired vampire arriving and watching Dr. Sun's facility from the shadows. And then below that, on both pages, kind of you get this side-to-side narrative of the melee happening, which is kind of cool. Blade turns his attention towards Dr. Sun, who opens a trap door under him into a shaft ending in wooden spikes.
Ooh.
As seen on the cover. Blade does his best, like, ninja warrior thing. He braces his extremities against the opposite walls, and with the opposing force, you know, of his extension, he catches himself, and even though his fingertips rip Jerry and there's blood making his fingers slide, he fights his way back up the shaft.
My hero.
With Dr. Sun's cronies defeated, Dracula makes a final assault on the boxed floating brain, and Dr. Sun is just fighting him off in this glorious ray of light. Then the Scoobies arrive and sneak in, and they almost trip over Juno's crossbowed headless corpse laying there.
Yeah, okay. Wait a minute. So, I need some explanation here.
It's now beheaded?
Yeah. Where's the head?
The crossbow is still sticking out of it. Huh. Here's, I think, a really significant case of having a writer edit himself. Here we get Blade somehow making a wrong turn, climbing out of what was like a 12-foot trapdoor shaft, and winds out topping out on the street outside, where he pays for his transgression by being promptly beaten into unconsciousness by Dr. Sun's mind-controlled army.
But not before he sees someone on the rooftop.
The white-haired vampire, Jerry. The one who killed his mother.
The one who killed his mama!
Alright, back to Dracula. Dr. Sun's light becomes a crucifix of light.
That sounds real bad.
That's the worst kind of light. Dracula turns into mist, and he is, like, poking Dr. Sun in the cortex inside his box. Drac fights through the light. You know, they say don't go to the light. He's going to the light, Jerry. He's going to the light.
Oh, man.
He flips the brain out of the box and onto the floor.
That's gross.
And then my poor meatball rolled right out the door. The Scoobies arrive at the room just in time to witness Dracula's final triumph with the brain lying exposed on the ground there. And Harold is like, it's time for me to finally do something. I'm going to smush the brain.
Yeah.
But Dr. Sun fights back with one last defensive laser blast. Dracula pulls Harold aside, and the blast inadvertently destroys Dr. Sun's life support computer system across the room.
Ooh, I'll bet he feels dumb now, Steve.
He doesn't have time to, because his brain spontaneously combusts into flames. As if there was any other way to combust.
Right. Man, it's too bad, because we're never going to see Dr. Sun again now.
The army's minds are now returned, and Blade wakes up from his concussion, complaining that he had the white-haired vampire right where he wanted him and everything, and now he doesn't have him.
No.
But he does come up with the idea that he's going to forcibly suggest that Dracula help him in his quest to get and find the white-haired vampire. And we will actually find out about that the next time we do these issues, which I guess that's next year, right, Jerry?
That's right.
But the next time we cover this title, though, it's the Doctor Strange crossover. And then in issue 50, the Silver Surfer. So that'll be a good
one. Hey,
that's
not half bad.
I know. And then, if we stick through this, we can go all the way to 2020 Halloween by doing like 10 issues a year.
Hey, that'll be a nice thing.
So Dr. Sun and the beheaded Juno.
Tell me more.
What happened there?
Oh, I was hoping you knew. I mean, I know.
I do know.
Dr. Sun shows up in Nova.
Well, who wrote Nova?
You did?
I read Nova. It was the hero in the tradition of Spider-Man, right on the cover, and that was back when John Buscema would do the first issues. He would do the first issue of Nova and then not be on it for the rest of the series. He would do the first issue of She-Hulk and not be on it for the rest of the series. But right. Marv Wolfman was the writer of Nova. And when that title was canceled, the dangling plot lines were resolved in Wolfman's other book, The Fantastic Four, which he left along with Spider-Man when he had to go across town and work for the Distinguished Competition, where he remained for the remainder of his days. So Wolfman kept Dr. Sun with him kind of wherever he went, except for to DC. Dr. Sun had beheaded the dead Juno and swapped brains, Jerry.
Oh.
While he was safely transported to another base, it was Juno's brain that was kicked around on the ground and poked by Dracula and everything and burst into flames.
Cold-blooded.
He builds himself a cyborg robot body and appears in the Nova series, the original Rich Rider Nova series. He discovers that Nova has a connection to this spaceship that orbits Earth and eventually gets himself on board that spaceship with Nova. And the Sphinx, who was Nova's big bad for that series, took control of that ship and flew to Xander, Xandar, you know, where the Nova Corps is and all that bit.
Mm-hmm.
And there, Dr. Sun projected his consciousness into the Xandarian computer network, which is known for its world mindness and all that stuff, right?
Right.
Well, then Nova's series was canceled. And the plot was picked up in the Fantastic Four sometime after issue 200, I want to say 204, 206, somewhere around there. The Skrulls are chasing the Xandarian princess. The Skrulls age the Fantastic Four. They have to go back to Xandar. They meet up with Nova and what's left of Nova's series out there. He had that Diamond Head and the Red Raven and some of those... not Red Raven, the Condor and some of those other characters that were hanging out. There was a few other... Crime Buster and the Sphinx. Well, that was when the Fantastic Four had a cartoon on television. And the legend was that the Human Torch wasn't used because they were afraid that kids would try to fly by lighting themselves on fire and jumping off of buildings. Right?
No.
But kids wouldn't do that. Kids are pretty smart. The reason why why Johnny Storm wasn't used in that cartoon was that he was optioned for his own series separate from the Fantastic Four, so that was already in some production, even though it never saw the light of day. So when they made the Fantastic Four, they couldn't use Johnny, and they came up with Herbie the robot. And Herbie was then inserted into the Fantastic Four comic by Marv Wolfman during his run. And that is where Dr. Sun's consciousness goes. Once they're on Xandar, he escapes Xandar by being inside Herbie the robot. And Herbie goes a little bad. Herbie kills a dude. Herbie joins the Fantastic Four in their search for Galactus, where they do Galactus a favor to find him a new herald, and they encounter Terax the Tamer. Terax the Terrible, and he becomes Terax the, you know, whatever he is. No, he was Terax the Tamer. He becomes Terax the Terrible. That's right. And via being part of Herbie, he goes all the way back to Earth, where then Dr. Sun launches his plan on the Fantastic Four to kill the Fantastic Four.
Which he did.
No.
Obviously.
No, he was defeated.
Oh.
Yeah. But he did control the weapon systems of the Baxter Building, and there's like a cover with the Fantastic, it's like split into four panels on the cover, and each of the Fantastic Four are dealing with some, you know, attack by the building that's meant just for them, you know? And it's all because of Herbie. No, it was all because of Dr. Sun from Dracula. The disembodied Chinese scientist who just wanted to rule the world, Jerry. Is that so wrong?
It's okay by me.
All right, we did this thing, right? We did our Halloween tradition.
We did it. So just in time, too.
It's true. Thanks a lot, Jerry. That was great, really.
Well, I hope it was spooky enough for everyone.
Does it really have to be until next... Like, it can be until next year for Dracula, if you want. But, you know, sometime in the meantime, can we read something else together? It's too long.
Sure.
I can't wait another... I can't wait a year. You don't do the Great Expectations stuff, even though that's worth... If you guys want to hear all kinds of X-Men and New Mutants talk, go back and listen to the Great Expectations podcast. Those episodes are timeless.
I got to get back on the internet first. It's gone. It doesn't exist anymore.
Oh, my gosh. Thank gosh I have downloaded episodes.
Ooh.
I will be bootlegging Jerry's podcast. I will also link to the old episodes on MarvelNoise.com that we covered the previous 31 issues. So you can go back and play along at home if you'd like.
Oh, man. Wow. I'm proud to be a small part of your legacy, Steve.
All right, gang. Until Dracula gets indigestion from Drake's cakes, make mine Marvel.
Mine too.
Later. I'm a vampire, babe.
Thank you.